to Heavy Potter's Heavy Cast, episode 72. This time, we're kind of in a different situation. We're recording in the middle of the week instead of on Sunday, because Eden has, because of daylight savings time, Sabbath was moved to Sunday, and Eden being a practicing Jew,
Did you know that one of the major points of contention between Anglicans and more radical Protestants was around which day is the Sabbath, whether it's Saturday or Sunday?
No.
And the fact that it fell on Sunday is only because when the English Civil Wars were over and Cromwell died and they invited back the king, they wanted nothing to do with the more radical Protestants, so Parliament passed a law officially saying that the Sabbath is Sunday and not Saturday.
So, when you're observing Sabbath, is it like, do you observe Sabbath in Israeli time, or do you observe it in wherever, if you're like, you're traveling right now, so
I mean,
do you observe it in local time?
That's actually also a good question. I mean, I don't observe Sabbath at all, so I don't care.
No, you as in not you.
I know. So in Israel, it's all about Jerusalem, right? When the sun sets, or the first three stars shine on Jerusalem, whatever, and that's like a 5 minute difference because Jerusalem is higher and like more to the east and shit like that. But when Jews are abroad, it's actually the first three stars wherever you are. Like it's the funny thing is the Old Testament puts a lot of weight on senses because it's not mystical. So when you see the third star, that's when the Sabbath begins for you.
Okay, then the next logical step is, if we one day we go to Mars, how do you observe Sabbath there?
That's a really good question. You should probably find like a science fiction rabbi and ask them.
Like, because this is always, there's always a question, like in Islam, they have actually debated if you're on the moon, like which way do you face to pray and stuff like that. And that's kind of an easier question.
Yeah.
But like, yes, I don't know. I don't know when you observe it. Why are we talking
about, I mean, this? Well, if you want to make it interesting, you could say that it speaks to the westernization of science fiction that we don't have good fictional answers to these questions, right? Like, if
for the most part.
For the most part. If I want to talk about Christianity in space, I have several resources to fall back on, like, for example, Dan Simmons and his Hyperion series and stuff like that. But the question of Judaism in space and Islam in space, maybe only Frank Herbert.
Yeah, I was just going to say, but that's, I'm not sure that's the best
representation. No, probably not, no.
Remember that time when Paul started space jihad?
Yeah, I remember that time.
Okay, space Jews aside.
I need a soundbite of that. Space Jews aside.
Yeah, well, there's a decent amount of Japanese and Chinese science fiction and how that applies, how their cultures would apply in these types of situations.
Yeah.
But yeah, there hasn't been a lot coming from, particularly the Middle East, that has been, hit the mainstream.
Yeah.
Yeah, which is a shame because it would be interesting. We always need more space Jews. I mean, there have been a lot. There have been a lot of space Nazis, so we need space Jews.
Yeah, to even it out, right?
Yeah, that's how it works.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah. This is,
give me more shovels, man. Okay. So speaking of shovels, Mastodon. So Brent Hinds of Mastodon, for whatever reason, went on Jamie Josta's podcast and said, Judas Priest isn't really metal, it's rock. And my answer to that is, well, Mastodon isn't really metal, so boom, got him. We got the money shot.
Oh, God. So Brent Hinds has kind of been a clickbait troll for a while now. He also did that thing where I never wanted to be in a heavy metal band. Mastodon is in a heavy metal band. Yada, yada, yada. And first of all, who cares if Judas Priest are metal or not? Let's start with that. Like, this isn't a genre discussion like we do, where we debate whether something is or not, because it helps us analyze it. It's just shitposting. And second thing, I want to say something that might be controversial. Judas Priest aren't metal. I mean, Why is that a point of contention? There, it's like Meshuggah isn't djent.
Yeah, well, kind of. Like, I could entertain arguments about whether Judas Priest is or isn't metal, and I think either side could make a legitimate argument.
Yeah, but not Brent Hinds.
Oh, yeah, not Brent Hinds. No.
And I mean, fine, do what you need to do to stay relevant. Is he literally a dad or just a dad in mentality? Like, does he have kids?
I have no idea.
Well, even if he doesn't, like, he's a dad at this point. He's not no longer on the bleeding edge of what Mel is doing today. So I guess you need to stay relevant somehow, and shitposting is a pretty good way to do that. As this podcast is well aware.
Yeah, of course. I mean, that's the only reason we're relevant. Let's not, you know.
Let's not kill ourselves.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, what I'm saying is let's not lie to ourselves.
Yeah.
Okay, so there's that. And then somehow somebody asked pulled Jonathan Davis of Korn into this conversation. He said, yeah, Korn isn't really metal either, so okay.
I love the banner image on that where it's him with a bagpipe.
Korn use bagpipes relatively prominently in their sound.
I know. It's just a very good choice by the editor as like kind of a middle finger because the picture is ridiculous.
Yeah. And I don't know why bagpipes have like people hate bagpipes like in general. They find the sound annoying, but I really love bagpipes for some reason.
I mean, I also like bagpipes, but I can understand why it's a very abrasive kind of sound, like
yeah, bro, I listen to Wormed, but bagpipes, no thank you.
I also think it has a lot to do with the depiction of them in media. They're always played bad in movies as like a comical punchline.
Defend bagpipes, no true bagpipe men. Okay, actually, random anecdote. When I was in Turkey, when I was in college, every weekend in the mornings, I would hear bagpipes out of my, like, in my bedroom.
That's
like,
odd.
Outside. And I was like, am I going crazy? Like, is there really bagpipes playing outside? Because, like, why would there be bagpipes in Turkey, right? And, I mean, we have a regional instrument called the tulum that is basically a bagpipe, but, you know, it doesn't sound exactly the same. And again, why would it be there? And I would ask my parents if they hear anything. They're like, no, what the hell are you talking about? But then, like, years later, I found out that, like, the school across me, for some reason, their band had a bagpipe player. I lived across the street from school. And, like, I would hear him practicing, apparently. And only I would hear it in our house because, like, my room was in, like, the corner. And, like, yeah, I don't know.
Incredible.
So the bagpipes were not fake. I wasn't like imagining ghost bagpipes. Speaking of ghosts and like spooky stuff, there's a new Karak Angren track, if that's how you pronounce that band's name.
Yeah.
It's called Song for the Dead. They're coming out with a new album called Dance and Laugh Among the Rotten. I think this band is super underrated, by the way.
I agree.
They're on Season of Mist, and they make like weird, really high concept symphonic black metal.
Yep.
I bet you didn't really get a chance to listen to this because I literally just put this on the agenda, but...
Yeah, I got the press release, but I haven't had a chance to...
It's weird, like, it's not fast, it's just very orchestrally heavy and, like, has a slow trotting, like, 1-2-1 type of beat. Like, it's kind of a more atmosphere piece, I guess.
They have, like, a voodoo thing, right, for their theme.
No, their thing is Ghost Pirates.
Oh, right. Well, that's kind of adjacent to Voodoo and stuff like that.
Bro, that's... I'm sure there's a cultural appropriation argument there somewhere.
Well, I mean, I'll trace the cultural appropriation. I mean, the southeast of the United States, like New Orleans, and the islands there kind of appropriated Voodoo culture as part of pirate culture. I mean, if you look at Pirates of the Caribbean, that's all over the place. It's actually Voodoo and not pirate at all, right?
Yeah. Did you watch the trailer for the new one, by the way?
No, I forgot to do that. It's also not one of my favorite franchises for some reason.
I can understand that, but I can give you an extended defense of Pirates of the Caribbean 3 at World's End.
I mean, the first...
Not any of the other ones.
The first movie was okay.
Yeah.
And then the rest of them are pretty terrible.
The fourth one is like... horrifyingly bad, but the third one has its redeeming qualities, but that's neither here nor there. This you know, this track isn't characteristic of Clark Angren, but then again, this band is known for doing uncharacteristic things. So we'll see how the album turns out. Yeah. It's on Season of Mist, so, you know.
Oh, speaking of Season of Mist, I also have something to add to this. Let me just trace down the band's name. So a very non-Season of Mist characteristic release from a band called Foscor.
They released... I think I got a press release for this, yeah.
Yeah, it's like a dark... ambient metal kind of thing. And the first track that they released has the singer from Primordial on a guest spot, spot. And I don't hear about Primordial enough. I love Primordial. It's like one of the first black metal bands I ever got into. I know they're not everybody's thing, but I really like them. And this Foscor thing sounds... The first track sounds okay. It's a bit too generic for me, you know, like Tesseract core, in a sense, because of the ambience and distorted guitars and stuff like that. But, you know, it's Season of Mist, so I'm going to check out the full thing when we have it. It's called... Oh, and the other thing interesting about them is that they sing in Catalan. They have Catalan lyrics and English lyrics as well. And the track is
presumably
called...
Presumably they're from the region?
Yeah, they're from the region, and this is the first release of theirs that's gonna have Catalan lyrics. And that fits in with the Primordial thing, because Primordial are, like, good, as in moral, nationalistic black metal. They sing about Ireland, but from a very sober perspective, and not, like, the...
They have
Yeah.
Don't they have, like, a Celtic... thing going
exactly we spoke about it when I talked about the compilation Altogether for Home.
Oh yeah
and they have like critical lyrics about nationalism, but that are still proud of their heritage and stuff like that as Irishmen. And these guys seem to be doing the same thing for like Catalonia. And the track is called Ciutat Tragica, which is the tragic city. It's cool. It has potential. I feel like if the album will be a bit more varied, I'd be happy with that.
Okay.
Yep.
And then there is a new Ulver track from The Assassination of Julius Caesar by the coward Marcus Brutus.
And the thing I like about this is that they released it on the Ides of March, which is of course the date of Caesar's assassination in William Shakespeare's The Assassination of Julius Caesar. And the track itself, you know, you never know what to expect from Ulver, right? They've done so many different things. And this is basically Depeche Mode. It's like dark wave, post punk, pop. It's cool.
It's good, but maybe not what you want, I guess.
I've just stopped expecting anything from them. I just roll with the punches because you never know like which direction they're gonna come from. And I like it, and I feel like they have one of the most solidly good, not great or excellent, but good discographies in the history of like our scene. Even their bad albums are still pretty good.
And they try things, and they are good at trying things.
Exactly. It never feels half-assed, right?
Yeah. Like this could legitimately pass as a Depeche Mode core song.
Yeah, for sure.
Okay. That's the news, because it's the middle of the week, so, you know, maybe more things will happen this week, and we will never get to talk about them.
Oh, no.
About them next week. That being said, one thing that I did want to talk about was what we've been listening lately, because I feel like that's kind of an aspect that a lot of periodic podcasts have, where, like, you know...
And we had it when we were starting out.
Yeah, we did, and then we kind of, you know... didn't do it anymore. We can bring it back, and you know it doesn't have to be an official segment, but it will be, if there is something that you would like to talk about, it will be cool. So
yeah, I would love to do that. I have some stuff.
Okay, go ahead.
So one band I really want to shine a light on, and they were a random submission to the inbox, and I told you to listen to them. I don't know if you've gotten the chance yet.
No.
Iapetus. So these guys make this progressive death metal. The album is called The Long Road Home. They're from Long Island. Thing about the album, the first thing you hear, the production is not that good. It's not as bad as, you know, some stuff that we listen to that's horrible, whether intentionally or not, but it's not that good. But if you look past that, it's a really incredible album. They bake the folk elements, the acoustic folk elements, right into the music. So it's not like, oh, here's a folk track, here's a death metal track. It's right in there, and it's just as good as the progressive death. It's not like, oh, here's a few chords that sound like a random folk song, but it's actually well written. And the growls are incredible. It's super high concept. I still haven't dug into the lyrics completely, but it has like four tracks that are above 10 minutes, and two of those tracks are 15 minutes long. But it doesn't feel like it goes on for too long and becomes still. It's a really, really interesting album from a band that is completely independent and unheard of. It's two guys. I really recommend it. The drums are obviously programmed.
Are the guys like from any other band, or are they just
no,
guys?
This is what they do. And the album, they're releasing it for free. Right? It's Name Your Price. Nice. Yeah, it's Name Your Price. They're doing it for the art. They're doing it for their passion. And you can really feel the passion showing through the music. It's a really good album. And I actually sent this to Anthony and told him to listen to this and maybe offer them to remaster it or something. Because if this had like professional production, this could be like one of the best albums I'll hear this year. I love it so, so much. And the production really reins it back. So I've been listening to a lot of that. I've also been listening to the new Aerion. And It's actually good. So you might know this, but for the listeners, I'm a huge, huge Aerion fan. Like, I drove to Rotterdam to see the Human Equation live. I flew there, sorry. And I love the Human Equation, and I love the Electric Castle and everything, but the last 3 to 4 albums from the main project and from the side projects haven't been as good. The musical ideas were stale, and the lyrics were very descriptive, you know, like, I'm going over there now I'm going over here, oh no, this happened, really weird. And suddenly, out of nowhere, he releases this album, which, one, has an amazing list of vocalists once again, James Labrie coming back, Anek, and other really, really, really good guest musicians, and the album is so good, he actually does new stuff, which he hasn't done in years, like new influences. There's a Arabic style singing track, which is really good, and it sounds like he got like actual singers that work in the genre. There's Queen influences and weird and like weird vocal harmonies. And again, there's a set list: Hansi from Blind Guardian, Tobias from Edguy, Russell Allen from Symphony X, Floor Jensen, which is now Nightwish's vocalist, Simone Simons, James Labrie, so just a really, really, really good vocalist, and it's an actual good album, which is very, very, very surprising and pleasing. So this is like an example of a band that you love coming back from irrelevance, and we always talk about the opposite of bands disappearing into irrelevance, so this is a cool, unexpected outcome for me.
Yeah, we had talked about you anticipating this album, and you're not having high expectations.
Yeah, I was very, very, I had very low expectations because, again, it wasn't that good. Oh, it also has Tommy from Between the Buried and Me, and Niels from Pagan's Mind. Yeah, this is like a really good, this is a really good set list. And yeah, surprisingly enough, I'm really glad I gave it the time of day. And the last thing I've been listening to a lot is Ninja Spy's new album.
Yeah, Spooken.
Yeah, that's a good segue into your list because I know you've been listening to this as well.
Yep. So I am the bigger Ninja Spy fan here, I guess.
Yeah, for sure.
Well, Cody's the biggest fan. He's been on the podcast before. We talk about movies, but yeah, so it's been a while since these guys made music. They had an EP, but it was, you know, it was just an EP, and they had an album in, like, when was Pie Nature? Like 2011, I think?
Yeah, I think so.
So yeah, it's kind of rare to see music from them. And also, it's interesting to see how, because it's like such a thing that its own thing, it's interesting to see how it hasn't really evolved in terms of sound too much, because like it's they're kind of going in their own direction, so it doesn't really matter what the rest of music does, really.
Yeah.
I did get a little bit more System of a Down-y vibes from parts of this one. I don't know if you felt the same way about this.
Yeah, I understand. Now that you say it, I can see the comparison.
I mean, the comparison has always kind of been a thing, but this one, there's even more of a feel there,
yeah.
I felt like. But that's not necessarily a bad thing. I like the album. I don't know if I love it yet. I didn't really get a lot of chances to listen to it, but my initial two listenings were pretty positive, and I'm looking forward to there being more Ninja Spy.
Yeah, I really like it, and again, I got a shitpost here and just say, these guys blow 12-foot ninja just out of the water.
Oh, yeah.
And just forget like the ninja stuff, even if they didn't have the same theme, the music is obviously within the same niche of 12-foot ninja, and these guys do it so much better. It's incredible, like a fun, groovy, kind of new metalish thing. So, so good.
Yep. Otherwise, another thing I've been listening to, I've been listening to a lot of Machine Head lately.
Oh, that's cool.
For no particular reason. I just really like them. And, mostly their last three albums, The Blackening, Unto the Locust. Well, actually mostly those two. And I think Unto the Locust is a really underrated album. I don't know if you have ever listened to it.
Oh, yeah, I love Machine Head.
But, like, in that album particularly, they've kind of done a more neoclassical-ish feel, and I really like that. Like, I Am Hell, Sonata, and C-sharp. Like, just so many cool moments in that album. Like, it's they just do moments really well, and then the build-up between the moments, and I just really feel
listening to them. I mean, from Through the Ashes of Empires, I think that Let Freedom Ring with a Shotgun Blast is one of the best metal moments ever recorded.
Yeah, that's a pretty good moment.
It used to be one of my go-to bar songs.
That's in Davidian, by the way, and it's their first album, Burn My Eyes.
I was just going to correct myself. In general, Davidian is amazing.
And otherwise, I've been listening to a random song. Despite myself, I've found myself enjoying the Power Trip album, Nightmare Logic.
Oh, yeah?
Crossover Thrash.
Are you a fan of Crossover?
I'm a fan of Thrash, and I don't like hardcore, but I've been feeling in the mood for a little bit of Thrash lately, kind of related to the Machine Head binging. And I listened to the new Havoc album, and the lyrics are just so fucking edgy that I just cannot. Like, it's like literally like preteen levels of the government is evil and they're lying to you and like almost like kind of weirdly right wing lyrics.
Yeah.
So I just couldn't. It was just so bad. Like every time I notice something going on with the lyrics, I just want to change the song. It's that levels of bad. And then I was like, nah, I just can't deal with this. So I just looked to what other thrash releases have come out lately, and I found out Power Trip's Nightmare Logic, and I've been really enjoying it. Like I don't really necessarily appreciate the hardcoreiness too much in this type of music, but here it's not super prominent, and whenever it is, it's kind of blended well. And also the songs are all of like decent length, but not too long, and also they have really good again build-ups, and like they flow just so well. It's really easy to start listening to a song and then realize you're like six songs into the album. So they just flow really well, and so I've been really appreciating that. That's been a big part of my listening. Otherwise, I've been wanting to listen to more music than I've actually been listening to music, if that makes sense. Like,
yeah,
I don't know if you ever have those phases where you're like, I just give me music, but then I'm like, none of this seems appealing to me right now.
Sometimes because we get so much music, like I have a to-do list. I use, let's chill. Maybe they'll send us money. Wanderlist.com. It's a really easy to use and sleek to-do list interface. And I use that to also for work, but also to keep track of all the releases that I need to listen to. And I have like 20 items right now on that list. And sometimes I'm just, I need to listen to something new. I open that list and I just get anxiety from all the like sheer volume of music that I need to listen to. And what that does, it just snaps me back to classic albums that I know that I love. Mm-hmm. And I just listen to a ton of stuff that I already know and kind of shy away from new music. And, also listen to less of it, because I feel bad about listening to stuff that, I'm going to put Weather Systems by Anathema. Ooh, Anathema, the old meme.
Oh, yeah.
I'm going to put
the money shot right there.
Oh, God. So I feel bad like putting on that album because I feel like I'm like betraying the music journalism, right? I need to keep going, to keep listening to new stuff, and instead I just go to this what's almost become like a guilty pleasure. But then I have that for a week and then I shake it off and say, hey, what the fuck, I'm gonna listen to whatever I want, because music is at the end of the day about enjoying myself.
I want to talk about that whole cult of the new mentality in a second, but before that I just remember one other thing. I forgot one step in my thrash journey. I got the promo for the new Warbringer album, and Woe to the Vanquished is the name of the album, and I had like the single Silhouettes from that album, and I listened to it, but I didn't like the rest of the album as much as I liked the single.
That sucks.
So that's why I went on a binge for like, okay, I need more thrash.
Yeah.
And that's how I ended up at Power Trip. So I guess I recommend the Power Trip album. So that being said, I occasionally think about this whole cult of the new mentality and like the constant pressure to, you know, catch up with the new thing and always be in touch with what's going on. And that's, we'll, you know, go into the goods and bads of that in a second, and the inherent kind of valuation of things because of their newness,
mm-hmm.
and also retroactively both devaluing things because they're old, and also conversely kind of overvaluing things because they're old as a reaction to the cult of the new.
Yeah.
So I kind of want to unpack this and talk a little bit about this.
Yeah,
and,
sure.
So, starting from the obvious, one thing that I said while explaining this bothered me already, where I said that, you know, there is this, I don't know, obviously I don't remember my exact words, but we have this kind of obsession with, you know, constantly trying to keep up with the new thing. That's not necessarily a bad thing, I think. I think it is good to always stay on top of developments, but I also think that it is important to... Just because, you know, something is not new doesn't mean it stops being good. And I think that's the mindset that it is very easy to fall into with any kind of media, not just music. But with music is especially kind of prominent because of, you know, production values evolving over time. It's literally a technological advancement. But again, that doesn't necessarily... I mean, if you go back to listen to Cynic's Focus, I think it still sounds great. So
I think that for me, I mean, there are disadvantages that run on two trajectories. One is the one that you touched on, where you have a disdain for the old, but I also think there's a disadvantage moving forward in the way that you think about why you're looking for the new. So,
oh yeah,
what is your?
By the way,
yeah,
just one more thing. I think we. Very early on in the podcast, I think we talked about this topic, but what you just said there was actually another direction that I wanted to kind of steer this towards that we hadn't covered before, which is the commoditizing of the newness. So
yeah, go ahead. That's exactly what I was going to say. And I think that it stems from, it's a matter of motivation, right? If mm-hmm. you chasing after the new by itself isn't bad. The question is, why do you do it? And as a result, how do you do it? So if you want to say it in a bit more academic way, the question is, what is your theory of the new and how you conceptualize it? And then what is the praxis of how you pursue new things?
Here we go.
Yeah, exactly. What is the, and if you want to, maybe something in the middle, what is the routine that is born from that motivation? And I'll explain why routine is important here in a second. Mm-hmm. I got a line of thought. So Plato,
just Plato.
Yeah, just
that's
Plato.
It. Mic drop.
End of discussion. So,
okay, moving on.
Yeah, one of the smartest things that Plato had to say, and that people kind of forget because it gets overshadowed by his political writings, is
he said to be or not to be. That it, no.
That is Plato. Yeah, William Plato, the famous playwright. So, it is the psychological part of the Republic, where he analyzes what is the good and the bad by comparison, soul, right? Mm-hmm. And the way that he does it, and if this sounds familiar because you've read Freud, it's because Freud ripped off Plato. The soul, I stand behind that, by the way, 100%. It's not just a shitpost. You know that Whitehead, a famous philosopher and mathematician, said that after Plato, all philosophy is footnotes.
Yeah.
So that's not true, but it's also super true. So he analyzes the soul and he says that it has three parts, right? It has the, and again, excuse me, anybody who's actually read this in a proper translation, I'm translating from Hebrew, which is from the Greek, to English. So the first part is desire, right? And that's what, you know, keeps you going physically. Hunger, sexual drive, the passions. That would be a better translation of it. And then the second part is the most like difficult to describe. It's kind of like courage, but it's also about like willpower. And it's basically like the way that you stand up to the outside world, right? Plato calls it like in a loose translation, like the fire of the soul, right? The way that my high school philosophy teacher explained it is that when you go to grab a parking spot and someone takes it from you, do you have that part of you that rolls down the window and starts shouting at him, or do you just drive away? And then the last part, of course, because it's Plato, is reason. And that's what analyzes the world and studies philosophy and thinks about the ideas, you know, the ideas in a Platonic sense, and understands math and geometry and all of that. Okay, we're getting there. We're getting to the point. And in a righteous slash good slash beautiful slash truthful, which is all the same thing for Plato, in that soul, reason uses the fire of the soul. It harnesses it in order to curb the passions and together strive towards good. So you need the passions. The passions are a good thing. It's not like this Western ascetic Judeo-Christianity where the passions are bad, right? And you have to resist them. They just have to be harnessed, like a team of horses to a carriage. And what helps you harness it is this passion.
And you never want to put Descartes before the horse.
Holy shit. Well done. 5 points. So, and then the passion of the soul is what helps reason, you know, rein in those passions into a good place. That's when we come back to listening to new music. That's the right attitude towards new music. Your reason wants to appreciate the beauty and the innovation in new music. It uses the passion that you have for new music, that fire in your soul that allows you to sift through good and bad music and cut through the amount of music that you can hear online today, even for as a listener, not just as a journalist. And it kind of curbs those passions, those base desires, into not always galloping ahead. But what happens often for people is that they get caught up in the thrill and the hype of discovering something that is new just because it's new, right? The passions overtake reason and kind of commandeer that fire of the soul, right? And they get caught up in this cycle of fulfilling that rush, that thrill that they get when they listen to something new. And it no longer becomes about whether this new thing is actually interesting, actually good, actually contributes something new, but becomes a fad, right? They chase after that thrill. And the last thing here, just to complete
it. For the sake of it.
Yeah, and then I'll shut up. In another text called Gregorias, Socrates says something very good about this. If you have a barrel and it has a hole at the bottom, it doesn't matter how much wine you pour into it, the barrel will always be empty. The man who's obsessed or possessed by his passions thinks that the solution is to keep filling the barrel with more and more wine faster to counteract the fact that the wine is dripping out of the bottom.
Whereas the solution is to just stick your dick in it.
Yeah, you got it. No, that's Freud. You're back to Freud. Whereas the clever man realizes that, you know, either you fill in the hole, not with your genitalia, or you change the barrel, or you stop drinking wine. That's like the end result, right? And it's the same thing here. Like the person who's able to take control of that drive for the new manages to harness it for good, to keep being relevant, to keep being cutting edge, to keep being innovative, and to keep saying interesting things without giving in to the rush of the new. That's it. That sucked. But like, there's a ton of inaccuracies there, but that's pretty much how I think about this thing.
No, I think that's both a valid point, and also there's not much to add on to it there. But one thing that I wanted to kind of latch on to from that long thing that you just said was that the whole kind of passionate, almost emotional response to the sheer newness of something. And I think that that is an interesting phenomenon, because for me, when I listen to music, I always like hearing something I didn't expect. There's a very chemical, neurological response almost when I hear something in music that is like, okay. You know, it's a very like primal response. But for me, that's always a driving factor, because when I hear some new music and I'm like, oh yeah, this is cool, I didn't see that one coming. And that's like a very, very big factor when I listen to music. And obviously, the more you listen to the same thing, the exponentially dropping rate of you getting that feeling is a problem. And then it goes into a kind of different feeling of familiarity, right? It's almost like marriage, I guess.
Wow.
Like, I mean, that's how people talk about marriage,
yeah,
right?
That's, yeah.
So it's almost like a different category of how you react to the music, where instead of appreciating the surprise factor, you start appreciating the familiarity factor. And this is always kind of been how I've conceptualized thinking about music. But I know dudes who legitimately get upset when they are surprised by music. Like, they don't want that feeling. That feeling is negative to them. They hate it. So they always want to hear things that are either super familiar to them or very closely adjacent to the thing that they're familiar with, so that, you know, they never want to step outside and encounter that feeling that they dislike. So, and I'm trying very hard to not sound judgmental here, but it's exceedingly difficult for me to not do that at this point. But I don't know if you also feel that way about kind of the response that one gets to something that is because of its sheer newness.
Yeah, I mean,
regardless of any sort of kind of quality, completely, there's like a completely orthogonal dimension to that.
I mean, I also try to not be judgmental, because I understand that some people look for different things in music than I do. And they're not necessarily...
just inferior things.
less good. but I do think that it's always a shame to me, because I know it's like paternalistic as fuck and patronizing, but I feel like they're missing out on so much. Like, even if you like... I'm not saying, you know, everybody should listen to avant-garde vaporwave with like whale birth samples or whatever, but but like, even if you just like thrash, if you just listen to something, well, I chose thrash, right? Because it's the most conservative of genres, and it tends to have like the most conservative of listeners. But I know people who won't listen to Vector because the vocalist sounds too much like Chuck Schuldiner, and that's too new for them and outside of thrash. And like, that's not even new. He literally sounds like a guy who's already made music, right?
Yeah.
I just feel like they miss out on so many cool moments, and this is maybe the main point for me, new ways to think about the music, right? New angles, new perspectives. So while I don't want to judge, I'm also kind of judging and saying that...
I mean, that's how I got into a lot of music that I'm into, and... you know, relevantly to just what we discussed a few minutes ago, that's how I got into Power Trip, because like, I don't like crossover thrash. I don't like hardcore, and I'm not a huge fan of thrash, and sometimes I get into the mood for it, but I kind of was like, okay, you know what, I'll just give this a shot, and then sat through it, and I was like, yeah, okay, I dig this, you know? And if I just immediately listened to that gut response of, no, I don't want this, then I would not have gotten this, and now I'm happy that I did get it.
There are a ton of albums that I've needed to give, like, second or third chances to even like them. Like, I listened to them one time, and I was like, yeah, I don't like this, but something about it, and it's a matter of habit, right, and instinct. The more you listen to music, the more you learn to recognize qualities that are, quote-unquote, huge air quotes, objective. That might lead you to listen to something like more times. Some albums, you put them on once and you're like, this is absolute drivel. For example, Gojira's Magma. the new Suicide Silence.
Right?
No, that one I can totally get behind.
So, but then there are albums.
I sat down and listened to that whole album.
Yeah, like, you did. But then there are albums that you listen to once and you're like, I don't like this, but something is here. There's something good about it. Maybe I just need to change my perspective. So a few good examples for me. We just spoke about Ulver. The first time I heard like Mess, whatever, 2020, the weird opera one, I was like,
yeah.
What the fuck is this shit? This is terrible. This is just like two guys wailing on their instruments. But there was something there. And then I listened to it a few more times and I suddenly realized. And you
I mean, still that, but...
Yeah, it's still that. But you kind of make sense of it. And it's like, you know, the philosophical issue of when do a few grains of sand in your hand turn into a pile of sand?
Mm-hmm.
So you can't really pinpoint that transition. So it's the same thing here. It's not like... I can pinpoint the second where I was, oh, this is a good album. Just slowly, in an ambient sort of way, it grew on me, right?
The rice sack of Theseus.
Yep. Yeah. What?
Like, Theseus' ship, you know?
I know the ship.
But, you know, grains of rice, you know, when is a grain of rice is actually like a sack of rice. So, Theseus... I don't know. Okay, so, like, you know, it's the same analogy. Theseus has a sack of rice that he's carrying from, like, one city to the other.
Yeah.
And, like, every few steps, he's super clumsy, so he spills some of the rice, and then, like, he finds more rice and puts it back in the bag. Is it still the same sack of rice at that point? Is it even a sack of rice? Is it multiple sacks of rice?
Do you remember Terry Pratchett's version of this paradox?
I did read it. I remember reading it, but I don't remember what it is.
So, the dwarves in Ankh-Morpork, they have this axe, which was supposedly the axe of, like, the ancestor dwarf, but every single part of the axe has been changed over time.
Yeah.
And then, is it the same axe of the ancestor, or is it a new axe?
Basically, napalm death.
Wow, that's interesting. Yeah, I mean, we always ask the question, in what way is Heritage's Opeth... still life's Opeth, right? Because there's only one member that's shared between the two groups. So, but two more things I want to say about the issue of innovation and newness and chasing that thrill. One is that we need to pay attention to how labels and marketing firms take advantage of that addiction to the new. And that's basically what drives the whole hype machine, right?
Of course.
People's desire to... to listen to something new, and when you're like the meme, like the virtuous Aristotelian who understands the true measure of things, or my version of it, virtuous Miltonian who understands meter. This went super obscure. This went and it's like impact font over a picture of Benedict Cumberbatch for some reason. So if you're that guy, then you're more resistant to the hype because you wait for the single, you wait for the track, and you like look it for the lens of, okay, this is new, but is it actually interesting? That's one thing. And the second thing is we'd be hypocritical if we don't talk about it, the role of music journalists in often, you know, like we spoke about the second album syndrome.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like that has a part of it, right? Something truly new and innovative comes along, like Def Heaven's first album or Oathbreaker's first album, or what other example is it of a second album syndrome?
Yeah,
a sense of gravity to an extent.
Ooh.
Oh, like nobody really gave like listened to Travail and reviewed it, and then everybody was on.
Yeah.
Fuck. Atrament. Sorry, guys. I know that Brandon is probably listening. Sorry. And like, whether you think that Travail...
Eben was just telling me how much he hates the new album right off when we're off the air.
Yeah, I was. But whether you think that Travail is better or not, like, Travail has a lot worth paying attention to, but music journalists kind of latch on to where it's easy to come in, and then they hype, for example, Sunbather. Right?
Yeah.
They hype Sunbather as this new thing, this genre-breaking thing, where in actuality, the same band have already done it, and other bands in the genre already exist. But for them, it's this new and innovative thing that they have to sell to their audience, right?
Yeah. I feel like as journalists, here's how I justify that, is that we provide a service and people are welcome to, you know, come and read what we write. But also, I am going to trust the listeners slash readers enough that they can, you know, make the decisions for themselves. And I will also try to highlight old stuff as much as I do highlight new stuff. So,
I mean, again, there's no problem with highlighting new stuff, but I feel like building stuff that isn't innovative to this innovative standard because it gets you more clicks. Like the sentence, "This is the most groundbreaking black gaze album I've ever heard," sells less than "This is another good addition to the black gaze genre," right?
Sells more than, you mean?
Sells more, yeah. I'm an idiot.
Yeah.
But sells more.
Yeah. No, yeah, I mean, that's kind of... I mean, that goes into the topic of, like, the nature of marketing and what's... I mean, it's completely untruthful oftentimes, but, you know, that's just the name of the game, I guess, and you gotta play it, or... I don't know. I didn't have a cool one-liner to kind of top it up.
So,
but we can... Yeah, sorry, yeah, go ahead.
I mean, I want to move on from this topic, so if you have anything else to say, then now's the time.
No. No, that was
so it. Another, like, recurring segment we kind of let fall by the wayside is the underrated release.
Yeah.
And I'd like to bring that back.
Okay.
Especially because I have something really new to talk about.
Oh.
Yeah.
Of course, you want to highlight something
new. Of course, because I'm a music journalist and my passions are overtaking my penis. That was the thing, right?
Yeah. Oh,
God. Okay.
Phallic.
Good thing that we're explicit on iTunes.
Yeah. Which is kind of hilarious.
Yeah, it is hilarious. Whatever. We're not that explicit. Anyway. Yeah.
Fuck.
That's like James Hetfield on the new Metallica album, where he says fuck that one time, and you can hear that he's super happy with himself for saying fuck. James, you're adorable. Okay, so Atsuko Chiba.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, sure. This is a Canadian band that does really, really interesting things. So at the bass, it's post-rock, but...
What about on the guitar?
Sorry?
You said at the bass, it's post-rock.
Fuck off. So, God damn it. So post-rock, but then put in like... How do I even describe this? Like Beastie Boys like rapping. So like white rapping, right? Not African American hip hop from the 90s and stuff like that, but more Run DMX, Beastie Boys kind of rapping over that post rock.
Run DMX. Okay, never mind.
I mean, Run DMX. Okay, we're not gonna get into that conversation because neither of us are knowledgeable enough. But that's the like the.
You said? Do you mean Run DMC or do you mean?
DMX? Oh, Run DMC. Sorry.
Okay.
Run DMX is something else. So and punk influences into the mix, and somehow it all fucking works. Like, it doesn't feel jarring or weird. So they have an album called Jinn, so that's J-I-N-N.
Mm-hmm.
And then they have a few
which
EPs.
Means genie, by the way, for those of you pleb westerners who don't speak Middle Eastern.
Shouldn't it have like a D before the J?
Depends on where it's coming from.
Yeah.
Like, who's like different countries spell it differently. In Turkish, they spelled C-I-N, Jin.
Do you remember the super racist distinction that Heroes of Might and Magic made between a Frit and Jin?
I remember the there being a distinction, but I don't remember.
Like, Jin was blue skinned and Western toned and physicality, and a Frit was like cliche Arabic dude with a curling mustache and a turban.
I remember the Frits being like flamey, or maybe that was another game.
Yeah, they're flamey, but if you look at their faces, that's like kind of their vibe. Back to this.
Well, if you really want to go into the mythology of the Middle East, they are kind of different creatures.
They are different creatures, yeah.
Ifrits are more like demon-like and fire-based, and genies are, well, they are still kind of, never mind. they are malevolent spirits.
Yeah, and they're like air-based, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So, back to the music. it's very, very impressive that they can blend all these influences, and as time goes by, because Jin has a few years under its belt, but they've released The Memory Empire this year or last year, which is an EP that kind of doubles down on the hip-hop stuff. It's super interesting. And if you're talking about new stuff that is also good, it's not just the innovation of like, ooh, look at us, we do weird genre mixes. It actually works to create a very distinct atmosphere and vibe to the thing. So yeah, go check it out if any of that sounds good to you. They're incredibly talented. And they're a good example of a band who experiments and does new stuff, not just for the sake of the experimentation.
You know what band, what album named Jin is actually good?
What? Which?
Melekeş's Jin from 2001. Are you familiar with Melekeş?
Yeah, those are the guys who play in like 420 hertz or whatever.
432, yeah. So, but they're Israeli, right?
There's a connection, but I don't think they actually are.
I think they are Israeli, but they don't live there anymore. Or they had... Because... Yeah, I'm pretty sure. Okay, never mind. But I love Melekeş. Great. They're like black metal with Middle Eastern folk influences. Very heavy. And Jin is their second album from 2001, with a D this time. And it's really cool. Like, if you like Nile, for the more kind of Nile Egyptian type stuff, Melekeş is basically kind of in that vein without the whole crushing death metal sound. And
so yeah, they were founded in Jerusalem.
Okay.
But they are Israeli Assyrians and Israeli Armenians.
Okay.
Which makes sense because most of the Assyrian, which is still like a distinct community, and the Armenians live in Jerusalem and Bethlehem within Israel.
Okay. So, yeah, cool band, really cool band. I don't know if you have you seen them live ever?
No, they left Israel like a while ago. They're in Amsterdam right now.
Okay. Well, yeah, they're due for a new album. They had Enki in 2015. Yeah.
Yeah, like they don't put out Their farewell gig in Jerusalem was in 1998.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
All right. Okay then, so that's that for music, and we can talk about cool people.
Cool stuff. People.
Or we could talk about epistemology if you
want. Isn't epistemology for cool people? No, it really isn't. It really isn't.
I mean, we could talk about that notion epistemologically.
Name one cool epistemologist. I dare you. kind of Russell, though he wasn't really he was cool, but he wasn't an epistemologist.
I'm going through a list right now because not a lot of people are like just epistemologists. Everybody talks about epistemological,
like, known as epistemologists. Like, you could say that Kant, he wrote about a lot of stuff, but he was definitely an epistemologist.
Yeah, well, but Kant is cool, I guess.
What? No, he's not.
He's cool in how ridiculous he is.
He died. I mean, he died a virgin that never left Königsberg. Literally, never left the limits of his own town.
Yeah, but he wrote the Critique of Pure Reason.
That's so cool, man.
that book is the stupidest thing ever. Like, we talked about this like a couple episodes ago, and yeah. Well, you know, nothing in philosophy is cool. So
I mean,
except Nietzsche's mustache.
And Russell was super cool. Bertrand Russell.
Yeah, okay. Wow.
Okay, so this guy, he was like a player. Like, what do you call it? Don Juan, right? Until he settled down. And when he was 95, he got arrested for protesting like nuclear weapons, and he went to jail. There's a story about how he nearly died in a plane on the way to Norway. But he survived, although like tens of other people died in the plane crash. He was a badass.
Okay, fine. Bertrand Russell can't be a badass. I'll allow it. Okay, yeah. Okay. Yeah, but Nietzsche's mustache, though.
Nietzsche's mustache, definitely. Do you know the story? We're just shitposting by now, but yeah, do you know the story of Ludwig Wittgenstein and his assistant?
No.
So Wittgenstein's assistant was a genius in her own right. She was like a mathematical professor, and she was drawn to him late in his career because of his, you know, work on logic and stuff like that. And he would he would drive her like a slave. Like, he would have her marking grades for his students and stuff like that. And the legend goes that one time he came back to where he would, like, his office where he was working, and she was sitting there, and she looked like very distraught, and he asked her what the matter was, and she told him that she gave a student the wrong answer, and she's very worried that he, like, take the mistake and carry it forward, and she's super concerned about it, and she's not sure if she can take it back because she doesn't know where they are, blah, blah, blah. And then he just pauses and he looks at her and says, "Yeah, you were never that smart." And just walks away.
And that philosopher's name was Albert Einstein.
Yeah, that's how Albert Einstein got into physics. Okay, cool people section. Hey, Albert Einstein was cool.
Yeah, he's cool. He's doesn't really count as a philosopher, but he was cool. I mean, there's all these stories about how he owned atheists in high school, right?
Yeah.
Right. I'm not sure if I should just explain this joke or not, because
don't explain it. Don't explain it. It's better unexplained.
Okay. So I mean, the section is called Cool People Time, yet I mean, you didn't like Logan, so are you cool? I don't know.
I did like Logan. I did like Logan, though. I just didn't think it was great. It was a good movie. It just wasn't a masterpiece like some people made it out to be.
Okay, let's talk about
spoilers.
Yes, I think to talk about this movie, we need to spoil it.
Yeah, I agree.
And I don't think we really have anything else to talk about, so we can just talk about this movie.
I want to talk about Shadowban.
Okay, let's talk about that one first, and then we'll do Logan, so that, like, people, if they don't want to hear spoilers, okay, they can just fuck off.
So, last week, well, Sunday, I was saying that I'm reading Shadowban by this guy called Steve Erickson. By the way, since then I've discovered he's, like, super famous, and he has awards and shit like that. And this was, like, New York Times, one of the most expected books for 2017. It's not, like, some obscure guy. And the first 60 pages, it was not, it didn't grab me. So the story is, like I said, the Twin Towers, that is World Trade Center, reappear in the middle of a highway in South Dakota. And then, like, a crowd gathers and music starts playing, like a different song to every other person. It plays in their head. And, like, it's all Americana folk stuff. But from all over the range, so like blues, jazz, rock, and folk. And then the other storyline is that in one of those towers kind of manifests, I guess, Elvis Presley's stillborn twin. He had like a stillborn twin in real life. So, but he comes from a timeline where Elvis Presley was stillborn and not him. Okay.
Yeah.
And then the other storyline is that a brother and a sister set out of California and they're road tripping to Michigan. And on the way, they get diverted towards the towers. And they're listening to their dad's playlist. Like, their dad always made a playlist. Okay. And everything is very House of Leaves in the sense that, like, it's linear, but knowledge is broken. It's like the playlists intersect with the other storyline and the songs, like snippets of lyrics, stuff like that. And it's written in this very sparse American existentialism style. But then stuff gets really interesting. Apparently, and I'm not spoiling, like, the end of the book because I haven't finished it yet, but apparently, like, Elvis's stillborn brother, he's the, like, the god or the personification of the death of music. Because in his timeline, Elvis didn't kickstart American rock and roll. So the Beatles never succeeded in America. And rock never became a thing. And it kind of petered out after a few years. So he's like the antithesis of music. And
okay,
he, like, brings that antithesis to our timeline and music dies. And the only place where music is still happening is in the sister and brother's car from their dad's playlists. And as they hitchhike, like, road trip across America in their car, they're, like, dragging music behind them. And that's when shit gets interesting. Because it has a lot of thoughts about, like, the cultural role of music, how musical knowledge gets disseminated. It was obviously written after Trump was either a candidate or elected, because it's all about how America is torn in two and culture is dying and yada, yada, yada. But the brother character, Jesse Presley is super interesting. There's a review that he writes in like 68 of his own timeline of the Beatles. And like he meets John Lennon, and somehow John Lennon knows that he's from a parallel reality. And he starts to berate him and tell him like, we got you, you're a piece of shit, we needed your brother, because of you there's like no hope for rock culture, and you killed the Beatles and you killed this music and stuff like that. It's super interesting.
It sounds like it could either be super interesting or a massive train wreck.
But it's not. It's super interesting. But I still need to finish it. I'm halfway through, and I've yet to see if he can actually close off all this insane like storylines.
Well, I hope it's a massive train wreck.
Speaking of massive train wrecks.
Okay, wow.
No, it's not a massive train wreck.
Yeah. Was there a train in the movie? There wasn't.
There was a train, yeah.
Was there? Oh, yeah.
He runs away with the girl from the place.
Okay. Logan, and there may or may not be spoilers within this discussion.
Definitely spoilers.
Yeah, I mean, there will be spoilers. all right, so let's talk about Logan. So... Okay, let me kind of set this up, and then you can kind of bounce back, and then I can push back and whatever. So, despite enjoying superhero movies, I think they're mostly trash, but that's okay, right?
Yep.
I mean, Red Letter Media style, you know, you can enjoy something that's schlock and yep. be fine with it. However, I think there's a range of trash that superhero movies are.
Definitely.
I think the Marvel movies are enjoyable, Marvel being Disney Marvel, the real deal, Avengers universe, are enjoyable schlock that is, you know, fine, fun. You know, it's entertaining. It gets kind of old after a while, but, you know, it's kind of like watching a medium-tier TV show.
Yep.
Almost. And then we have the fake Marvel stuff, which is Fox's and Sony's Marvel, and they've all been pretty bad in my opinion,
mm-hmm.
because they try to be really serious and they just don't nail it. They don't have the vision that the rest of the Marvel stuff has had, and it just seems like they didn't have the talent that those guys had. Nothing against like the actors and whatnot, but like the screenwriters, the CGI, the camera work and stuff is never up to par.
Yep.
And then we have DC, which is, well, I mean, I think the DC stuff tries to do something in a way in that, like, you know, Michael Bay thinks he's an auteur, but Zack Snyder thinks he's an auteur. And I think Zack Snyder, when given good source material that he sticks very, very rigidly to, I think he's a good visual guy, but his movie making in general is pretty bad.
Mm-hmm.
The casting choices for the DC stuff have been bad to disastrous.
Yep.
And those movies feel like, I don't know who the fuck wrote these and what the fuck they were thinking and like who they thought it was going to appeal to. Those are just disasters. So that's where I think the landscape is.
Yeah.
I think Deadpool was the closest Fox's Marvel got to, you know, being
to one greatness. Of the
big league players. Yeah, yeah.
I agree.
Because it was, you know, it was a one-off thing made by a few people on a shoestring budget, and, you know, nobody expected it to succeed, so they didn't put the studio hooks into it, right?
And like Ryan Reynolds' redemption went a long way towards selling it.
Yeah, and, you know, he kind of may or may not have leaked the test footage that then he used to pressure the studio into turning it into a full movie because the audiences were very excited to it.
Yeah.
So, that being the landscape here, I think Logan is doing something that no one except for Christopher Nolan has done in the genre for a very long time, if ever. Is a deconstruction of the genre, which I think is much needed. Deadpool doesn't really count as a deconstruction, I think, because, I mean, that's kind of Deadpool's thing to be, you know, fourth wall breaking.
Mm-hmm.
And there hasn't been a deconstruction of this genre. And, I mean, there is Christopher Nolan things, but I always view the Nolan Batman movies as Nolan movies that just happen to star Batman instead of, you know, Batman movies made by Nolan.
Mm-hmm.
So with Logan, I had no expectations because I hate the Fox Marvel stuff. I think the Apocalypse movie was dreadful. I think Days of Future Past was dreadful with a few good scenes. And I thought First Class was boring with a few good actors and scenes. And so when it comes to Logan, it was, I thought, very well done because it was completely one-off thing. You know, no hooks to anything else. There was no kind of, okay, now we're going to turn this into a universe. And, like, there is no lore you need to know other than the basics of the characters. And most of it is kind of either explained in the movie or not relevant anyway. And I really appreciated that it was completely one-off. I really appreciated that it was a very small movie in a sense, in that there was no apocalyptic big world-ending thing or whatever. And going into more spoiler territory, I enjoyed how shitty everything was in terms of you never get any resolution, in a sense. You never get your heroic moments. It's basically life sucks and then you die, the movie. Mm-hmm. And I really appreciated that after everything that I just described about superhero movies. And one thing that I think is maybe an objective weakness, and you mentioned this and you might drill down on this a little bit later. The villains in the movie are all weak, shitty, generic villains. Yeah. And I actually like that in a sense because that's the thing. Like, there's no Wolverine isn't having this like epic battle of wits or battle of strength or whatever against someone who is his match, and like, you know, he's gonna come out the victor by being the smarter guy or like, you know, do the heroic thing. No, it's just a shitty villain who is like a jobber, but he also has a strong thing in his hand, so he can, you know. And Wolverine is too old to fight back, so he dies a shitty death or whatever. Like, I really appreciated how just shitty everything was. And that's kind of how I feel about the movie. There's more, but I'll let you have your piece first.
So, I mean, okay, so I want to separate what this movie tries to do and the idea that it has and how it actually translates to the screen. So, I agree that what they're trying to do is admirable, and that's what turned the movie for me from being a bad or just a fine movie to being a good one, because I appreciate the attempt, and I also like small stories, especially when those small stories are used in a genre that is usually big, like small science fiction, small space opera stories, for example, right? Mm-hmm. I like that stuff, and that's the stuff that I write as well. And I also appreciate the nothing matters, there's no ideal, even the shining beacon at the top of the hill that is, you know, Xavier, is a terrible mess of a man that maybe it's hinted towards killed everyone, like all the mutants fucking blew their brains out. Spoilers, by the way. And like Caliban is a fucking coward. And everybody's terrible. I super appreciate that.
And Xavier dies a horrible death.
And Xavier dies just like a stupid death. Just like someone comes in and stabs him in the chest.
And that's it.
Yeah, that's it. And there's no like battle of willpower and shit like that. I love all that stuff. And the problem is, and I'll start talking about it from the villain perspective, I don't have a problem with the villains being small and powerless. They're badly written. Their motivations make no sense. Their characters aren't established in any way. Like, literally, the Doctor is just introduced.
Yeah.
There's no exposition. There's no lead up to the guy. There's no reason for me to care about him or hate him or oppose him. And I need that stuff in order to enjoy the movie. Otherwise, it's just boring. It's just picking a guy from the street and saying, that guy is an asshole. I'm going to forward his plans. I don't care. He's just an asshole. And that's even what's even worse is the villain that does get established, that is the dragon in the TV trope dictionary.
The hand guy, right?
The hand guy, the cyborg guy. He constantly makes threats, but then he doesn't deliver, but in a shitty way. Not in a, I inverted it, he's just all bluster. It's just not well written. And then other parts of it are really badly written. For example, why does she, like, this is nitpicking, but it's important for me because it's, you know, shantification, the world doesn't make sense. Mm-hmm. Why does she have an Hispanic accent, the kid, but the rest of them don't? They were all raised by the same, okay, so she has an accent because the nurse is Hispanic, right?
Yeah.
But they were also raised by the same nurses. So why are they American? And it just felt like a shitty ploy to make her character unique. And then the kids themselves are terrible characters. There was so much potential there to do, like, cool X-Men stuff.
Yeah, that I felt like the kids almost, like, mostly didn't even need to be there or use their powers.
Yeah, and then when they do need to use their powers, they run away. And, like, yeah, I know that there's the whole, they're pacifists, they don't want to use their powers for bad, but then a second later, they fucking torture people and tear them apart.
No, I think when they ran away, I felt like, yeah, why aren't you just fighting back? But they're just fucking kids. Like, they don't know really how to fight.
But they do, because they're killing machines. They were bred for this and trained. Whatever, it's like a small nitpick. But the movie is filled with this kind of stuff, and it kind of felt like it tried to do a lot more. I mean, Nolan's was 3 movies, right?
Yeah.
Because it needed a lot of setup. Here, like, the family that takes them in, they die like 7 minutes after that, and I don't give a shit. It's supposed to be super tragic and like, oh my god, I can't believe that Logan has killed innocents again or inadvertently led to their deaths like he always does. But I don't care, because these guys were introduced like 2 scenes ago.
It was pretty obvious that that family was gonna die, but I think the takeaway from that scene was that Xavier got his one last perfect night.
I understand. It was just not well established or written in my eyes. But then the good stuff, and there was good redeeming stuff. Hugh Jackman did a fantastic job. I feel he played the character very well, and
very two-dimensional character, by the way. He played it really well.
It kind of stretched his range and what he does and expresses. And then Xavier was the best thing about the movie. Also because Xavier is my favorite X-Men character and one of my favorite Marvel characters, because I'm super drawn to characters that are like too powerful to ever use their powers. And Xavier is kind of like that. You know that if he wants to, he's strong enough to like destroy America or whatever. Like, his telepathic powers are off the chart.
Yeah.
And that's the whole conflict he has with Jane and the Phoenix and all that stuff.
And in this movie, they kind of lean into that with the whole...
they super lean into that.
Dementia, and so, like, it's really dangerous, and he's classified as a WMD by the government or whatever.
Yeah, exactly. And that was really well done. I love Caliban. He's a really cool character who makes too few appearances in the comic books. And
Stephen Merchant is great.
Stephen Merchant is an amazing actor. And then a couple of scenes, the X-24 versus Old Man Logan... is a super classic comic book thing, which was handled really well. Like, the power of teamwork enables the weaker hero to succeed. That's the classic trope, and it was played very well. The hotel scene.
That was amazing. Amazing. Like, that was so cool.
That was a really cool scene and really nailed home the Xavier is fucking powerful. Holy shit.
Yeah.
So that stuff was good. Overall, it's a good movie. But I don't feel like it accomplishes the deconstruction that it sets out to do, unlike the Christopher Nolan stuff, even though I fucking hate the third movie. And I think the third movie is trash, but Batman Begins and... Dark Knight Rises. Oh, Dark Knight Rises is the third?
Yeah.
Yeah, what the fuck? Dark Knight... So what's the first one?
Batman Begins, Dark Knight Rises.
Exactly. So yeah, Batman Begins, by the way, and...
Begins is great.
Get the pitchforks ready. I prefer Begins to Dark Knight.
I think that's what most woke people agree on.
Woke? No, like, Dark Knight is super woke. It's super like Joker quotes.
You know what I mean.
Yeah, I know. I think Batman Begins is one of the best comic book movies ever made, because it really captures like the juvenile and hero's quest feeling of it. And Dark Knight is fucking incredible. Don't get me wrong for a second. But it kind of gets weighted down by its own like grandiosity. Meme status. Exactly. Meme status and grandiosity and like statement. And Batman Begins, it's just a good comic book movie.
Yeah. The third movie, by the way, Dark Knight Rises, I think if Heath Ledger had lived, that movie was going to be very different.
for sure. But I also feel it has so many Nolanisms. And it's basically the movie where him being a literal billionaire comes through. All the shitty Occupy Wall Street is a tribunal of people executing lawyers, and like the glorification of the New York police force, and that's the storyline is a fucking mess. It's just a terrible movie.
But I think what I wanted to say was that I think part of the mess is attributable to the fact that they had to just hastily rewrite the movie.
No, I agree. I agree. It's just still a terrible movie. And Logan avoids a lot of those cliches and does a lot of things right. It just falls short of being a great movie. That being said, it's probably the best X-Men movie made.
Yeah, for sure.
Even though I enjoyed Days of Future Past and I enjoyed First Class to a degree, I think it's better than those, but just by a bit. And then it's miles, miles better than anything else in the X-Men cinematic universe, especially the older Wolverine titles.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think every time I watch one of the other X-Men movies, I always get the sense of why, like, you know, the CinemaSins channel on YouTube?
Yeah.
How they like nitpick movies. Mm-hmm. And like the nitpicks there for those movies are so real for me. Like, why are you doing this stupid? Like, everybody's so incredibly stupid in those movies, and everything is just mind blowingly full of plot holes and just overwrought and not. I just can't enjoy those movies. And with Logan, I totally didn't have that. I was following along with the movie because it felt so much more grounded, and I was able to appreciate what they're trying to do here, and because they were not trying to do some big contrived thing. And I agree with you on a lot of the flaws of the movie. Some of them I kind of chalk it up to what the movie's trying to do, whereas you find them to be flaws, and that's okay. But some of the flaws I do agree with you on. Yeah. But I think it's still good despite those flaws, and I think it's so unique that the flaw it kind of gets a pass for me.
Mm-hmm.
Because I tried to think, like, you know, what's my favorite superhero movie of the like past 10 years, let's say, since the Nolans, right? And the thing is, I just, even if I don't necessarily like Logan more than some of the other ones, it's just completely in its own category that I have a hard time comparing it to anything else. So it's even if maybe it's not my favorite, I feel like it has carved its own status that
I agree.
It deserves being mentioned.
Yeah. And by the way, I think that another thing to add here in its favor, and again, you know what? Why am I apologizing for being pretentious? This is super pretentious. I'm just going to embrace it. I feel like a lot of people who watched it and are going to watch it are going to miss the Western thing. So Western movies make a really big appearance in the movie, and the end titles, and there's no post-credit scene, and the music that plays and the Western quotes. This movie is about the death of the American hero.
There's literally a Western movie shown inside the movie.
Yeah, and a lot of the scenes are also very Western influenced. This movie is about, and this might be because I just spoke about and I'm reading Shadow Band, which is about the death of American music. But this is, in a way, about the death of, well, again, the Elvis Presley, Western, cowboy, pretty boy. That's the death of that hero. Mm-hmm. Because, as you said, Wolverine dies a completely unnecessary, simple, stupid death. And he doesn't,
in the
like,
middle of nowhere.
In the middle of nowhere. He saves like 10 kids.
Yeah.
He doesn't save like the world. He saves like 10 kids. And even those kids are probably going to a place that doesn't even exist.
And they're gonna like be persecuted and maybe just die.
And maybe some of them will become evil as well, because in the X-Men universe, we know what happens when you prosecute mutants, that like they turn to the other side. So I feel like that's a really cool thing that the movie did. You know, the whole thing with the cross at the end where she turns it on the side and it's the X-Men X and all of that. It was very blatant, but then again, kind of subtle in ways.
Yeah.
And I like that. It's a good statement, very relevant and pertinent to our day and age.
Did you notice the Wolverine action figure in the kid's hand at the end?
Yeah, there's a ton of like small things. The kid has like metal band posters in his room. Orchard Parish and Suicide Silence. Well, metal. I use that term.
And Dr. Acula.
Dr. Acula. And there's a lot of like little hints in the movie. And there's also, I like the trope service, like when Wolverine literally says, "I don't like guns." Mm-hmm. And then the last shot that saves him is a gun. Some of the stuff is played really straight, and I really appreciate that.
Doesn't he just straight up shoot someone?
No, but at the end, he uses the adamantium bullet, which is the last bullet trope. But when a superhero at the beginning says, "I don't like guns," then you know that the moment that he, like, what's going to save his life is a gun.
Yeah.
Like the exception to the rule. And that was just played straight. And I enjoyed that.
There was one more thing that I wanted to say. I liked the subtle world building in the movie where the corn company is alluded to.
Yeah.
And they talk about this disaster in Westchester, and Wolverine turns out the radio, and then Xavier says he remembers what happened in Westchester. Like all that like subtle stuff was pretty cool.
Yeah, I agree. So overall for me, a good movie, but not insanely.
I think like, even if it's even if it's not perfect, I think it's still a must see. Just because of context, like even if maybe it's a 4 out of 5 movie, but if I would recommend it over a bunch of 5 out of 5 movies because it's just a important singular thing for the genre.
Yeah, I would say that it is. 4.5 out of 7. So it's just below being great, but it's not as low as I would put the other X-Men's. So it's fine. It's good. Go see it for sure, but don't expect like a revelation.
Yeah, I think it's a good send-off to Hugh Jackman and I assume Patrick Stewart as well. And yeah. It's kind of a... It's amplified by the fact that we've been seeing these guys play these characters for, 17 years now. Oh, yeah,
that's the power of the franchise, right?
Yeah, but they actually do something with the franchise because, you have the Avengers movies that just keep going. And this one's like, you know what? We're done. This is it.
I mean, I don't know what they have planned, but like the next Avengers is supposed to be that moment for them.
Yeah, but that's going to be, presumably... one big movie where, a bunch of characters are going to die and it's going to be a heroic death. Whereas this one's
No. I'm not comparing the two. By the way, I'm super insanely hyped for Infinity Wars. Holy shit.
Didn't they kind of make... they separated into two movies. Originally going to be called Infinity War Part 1, Part 2.
Yeah.
But then they just called the first one Infinity War and the second one is going to be called something else, I believe.
I don't know. At this point, I trust them. They still haven't made, maybe the first Captain America, but that's debatable, like a bad movie.
I recently rewatched the first Captain America movie and having seen everything else that came to pass in the universe, I really appreciate it more than most of the movies.
I appreciate like the part that it plays in the universe, but I don't think it's as good. Like, it's not as good as Winter Soldier, in my opinion.
Oh, not as good as its own sequels, but it's better than, I think, the other individual movies.
Originals? Yeah, maybe. I don't know. Iron Man 1 was incredible.
For its time,
yeah. It hasn't aged well, yeah.
Yeah, okay.
Okay. I gotta do adult stuff now.
Okay. Oh, adult stuff.
Picking up laundry. That's adult stuff.
With your penis.
Yeah. Back to the Freudian.
Yeah, of course. Because Plato's ideal has inspired... I don't fucking know, man.
The shadow
of your penis on the laundry room wall.
The Ulver album called Shadows of the Penis.
The Valley.
The assassination of Sigmund Freud.
by the coward Friedrich Nietzsche.
Bye, everyone.
Bye.
Bye.